Good afternoon and welcome to the LaRouche Show. It's Saturday, July 28th, 2012. I'm Harley Schlanger and I will be your host today. On last week's program, we gave you a preview of what we at LaRouche PAC had prepared for this week and an all-out mobilization in Washington, D.C. and throughout the country. Given the accelerating rate of the collapse of the euro and the maniacal drive for war seemingly over Syria, but with Russia and China as the real target, Lyndon LaRouche put our organization on a full-scale, all-out mobilization to push through our three-point program through the Congress and get Obama out before the Democratic Convention opens on September 3rd. While we had seen some surprises in the weeks leading up to this, as some leading British financiers of the types that you wouldn't expect joined with LaRouche in endorsing the restoration of Glass-Steagall. We saw the leading newspaper of the bankers, the Financial Times, write not one, not two, but three editorials endorsing Glass-Steagall. We saw the exposés of the corruption of the banks. And of course, like everyone knows the banks are corrupt. Everyone knows they're speculators, they're thieves, they're crooks. But we now have it in their own newspapers. We have it before the British Financial Services Authority, before the British Parliament, in the U.S. Congress. Exposés of the rigging of the interest rates in the LIBOR, and also of the admission by the Hong Kong Shanghai Bank that they are the leading drug money laundering bank in the world, as they were in the 19th century, the 20th century, and they're continuing with that great tradition in the 21st century. So as these things unfolded, and were somewhat shocking and surprises, we knew that if we pushed things this week, there would be some other surprises in the offing. And of course there were, in fact, more and big surprises. One of them is an interesting story, which is the release of a book by Neil Barofsky, the Inspector General of TARP, in which he directly targets Timothy Geithner, the U.S. Treasury Secretary, and he's been all over the news talking about Geithner's role in covering up the fraud that was committed in the rigging of the LIBOR rate. We also, very shocking development, Sandy Weill, the person who is more responsible than anyone except perhaps Alan Greenspan for the repeal of Glass-Steagall. Sandy Weill, who put together the big deal between Citibank of New York and Travelers Insurance Company, and in order to get that deal finalized, they had to repeal Glass-Steagall. And he considers himself the person who was the destroyer of Glass-Steagall. Sandy Weill came out this week and said, we need to go back to Glass-Steagall. We need to break up the big banks. Then there were editorials in this week in the New York Times and the Los Angeles Times, both of which acknowledged that they had been wrong in their advocacy of repealing Glass-Steagall. The LA Times made an interesting point. They said that the reason Glass-Steagall worked and was so good is because it was simple and there were no loopholes, which is a point Lyndon LaRouche has been making for the last 10 years. The argument that the Dodd-Frank bill handles the modern innovations and so on, that it's so complex that the bill has to be, you know, almost 2,000 pages. The New York Times or the LA Times just said that's not true. The simpler bill means there's no way to avoid it, no way to get around it. So we had those surprises. And interestingly enough, as we were all over Washington, members of Congress were bringing up Glass-Steagall during the congressional hearings. When Geithner was brought before the Congress on the LIBOR, during the Hong Kong-Shanghai hearings and so on, people were bringing up the question of Glass-Steagall. So on today's program, we're going to get a report on the week's organizing, what we did and the effect that it had, as well as hopefully some indication of what you were doing, what the listeners were doing to mobilize your congressmen as we had a pincers action in Washington, where we were directly confronting the congressmen in their offices, in their hearings. And what you did in Boston, in Detroit, in Seattle, in West Overshoe, as they say, what you were doing to make sure that your congressman was aware that people in the home district as well were mobilizing on this. So we'll get that report, and then we'll look ahead to see what we're going to do this next week as we drive to remove Geithner and Obama and to reverse the ongoing 40 years of economic collapse. Joining me on the program today will be Michael Steger, who had been working on Dave Christie's congressional campaign in Seattle, Washington, and we'll probably talk about that because the vote is coming up on that. It's going on now because it's an all-postal election. But Michael came in from Seattle, Washington, to Washington, D.C., to help coordinate the mobilization there. And then also joining me, I'm very happy to bring to the program Bill Roberts, who's a member of the LaRouche congressional slate. He's one of two Democratic candidates on the ballot on August 6th for the congressional nomination in Michigan's 11th congressional district. And a victory for Bill would be extremely important as part, not for the sake of the election in that district, but as part of the recognition that there is a change in the country and we're not going to put up with this British Obama policy anymore. So, Michael and Bill, welcome to the program.
Thank you.
Thanks, Alex.
Yeah.
Michael, let me start with you because you were in D.C. this week, and I know from talking to you that it was quite an exhausting week. Why don't you begin by giving us a summary of how we deployed and what we did?
Yeah, sure. Well, let me just begin by saying first that As Lyndon LaRouche had indicated prior to this mobilization, the climate in Washington, D.C. has drastically changed. There is a recognition from the people who remain thoughtful within Washington, and this largely predominates within a number of staffers on the committees as well as for some of the congressmen and senators, that there is a fundamental crisis taking place. And the openness right now in Washington is unprecedented. I've been here a number of times to lobby for our policies, even going back to 2007 and the housing blowout. And the reception now requires that every citizen out there that has a concern for their nation and for the future of our country begin to participate as much as they possibly can. Calls into their congressmen and senators, a mobilization of your friends, of your political groups, into some level of lobbying, and putting pressure on Congress, because this week and the weeks following are crucial for this nation and for civilization. And I say that from direct experience. In the meetings with members of Congress, with Senate offices, in the committee hearings, you see a fundamentally different discussion taking place. So having said that, to give people an idea of how we're intersecting it, this, we've got up to approximately 30-plus people right now on Capitol Hill every day. And if people who have been here know, this is not a big place. It's a very concentrated area, and there are very crucial choke points of which a number of the senators and congressmen and their staff and people of the institutions participate. So at metro stops, at certain kind of locations like the executive office building next to the White House. And then, of course, there are just clear choke points coming out of committee hearings where you run directly into senators and representatives. So we had saturated this environment. That means that we've caught congressmen on the steps and in the hallways. Staffers confronted huge banners on the LIBOR scandal. I mean, it happened. What a unique circumstance that Timothy Geithner is sitting in hearings Wednesday and Thursday at the same time that Sandy Weill is coming out endorsing Glass-Steagall.
And, of course, Geithner was the person sent by Obama into the Dodd-Frank committee hearings when the bill was being drafted to explicitly crush the bill of Cantwell and McCain to make Glass-Steagall part of the Dodd-Frank bill.
Yeah, absolutely. And so you had a culmination of circumstances. That is how history essentially works. You fight on principle, you commit to that idea, and if reality is on your side, in which in this case it certainly is for us, Civilization's not going to survive if we don't get these measures passed. This week was incredibly phenomenal for the discussion, and I'll say that the impact of our intervention, we are changing the entire discussion of Washington, and we have to continue to keep that pressure up. But there is a potential to change the cultural outlook. There no longer can be adaptation to this system. A new system has to be created. So,
and Michael, let me just make the point that this initially was set up by LaRouche as a two-week mobilization because the Congress goes on recess at the end of this coming week. Is that still the case?
Well, hopefully not. I think the intention of this coming week is going to be a very emphatic that not only does Glass-Steagall have to be passed, a clear indictment of the Obama administration, if that means an impeachment, putting him on a kind of a controlled status, removing his nomination from the Democratic Convention on September 3rd. Congress has to address this crisis now. There is a reason why Sandy Weill and the New York Times and the LA Times and this West Wind from London has occurred. This is not just opportunism by Sandy Weill to avoid jail. There is clearly a crisis that is unavoidable. And if Congress does not take the steps to address it now in an urgent fashion, we are facing consequences that are, for many people, are unimaginable.
So, Michael, one of the things that people should say when they call their congressman is stay in session till you get this job done.
Absolutely. But
that's the message.
Yeah, we need a policy now for the future of our country. If people look at this Colorado case, and Mr. LaRouche brought up a number of these points in discussions with associates this morning, this Colorado case exemplifies the downfall of a younger generation. And I don't know if this has been pointed at. There's been clearly too much press coverage of these types of incidents. This culture shows its lack of moral commitment by making these things a way of achieving some form of distorted fame. But the particular case of this young man, he was granted one out of six federal grants for a PhD in neuroscience. We have a failure of our curriculum in the highest levels of science to educate the younger generation towards a future for mankind. And we have to begin to address that problem as a society and in policy these coming weeks, right now. And I think that's the point. Congress has to stay in session. They've got to get a policy developed, a platform. So one thing we're going to do real quick, we are going to put out a pamphlet laying out a basic policy platform for this coming week and make sure that that's in the hands of the staffers and the congressmen and committees that should give us a sense, give the American people a sense that there is a dedication to the future. And that's certainly something that all American citizens can participate in right now.
And just for those people who haven't been on the program before or don't see our website that often, because there are a lot of new people who are being brought in, what is the centerpiece of this policy platform, the three-part program?
Well, it was interesting what Mr. LaRouche said today. The point is that with Glass-Steagall now coming into the fore, clearly as an imperative in the immediate future, we have to now think like Johann Sebastian Bach. We have to now take this transition and think, what will the future be? The first step, we've got to destroy this environmentalist agenda. Now, if we destroy that, that means we open up the door for the full-board NOAPA development policies, getting the younger generations into productive areas of work. That's going to require a complete overhaul of a banking system back to a national banking system. And that means also looking towards the real future, which is a nuclear society, a fission-integrated society under thermonuclear fusion, and what that really entails for the human species, a much greater mastery of our solar system and the galaxy beyond. That's got to be the orientation, and there's some immediate steps. The National Bank and NOAPA are our first immediate steps to take once we get this Glass-Steagall policy implemented.
All right, well, you've just been listening to Michael Stager, who will be with us for the full hour. Michael is one of the coordinators of the mobilization underway in Washington, D.C. right now by LaRouche PAC. And now let me bring in Bill Roberts. Bill has a primary a week from this coming Tuesday. He is really the only Democratic candidate in the 11th Congressional District. He has an opponent who claims that Bill is a phony Democrat, but his opponent has no legs to stand on. So, Bill, what were you doing this week? I know that you're in the final phase of the campaign, but for the LaRouche slate, the drive for the election is actually really a fight to provide leadership for the nation. So why don't you give the listeners a sense of what you were doing in the Detroit area this week, and also what the slate as a whole is doing.
Right, exactly. Well, yeah, as you said, even though both Dave Christie, who's running in the 9th District in Washington, and myself have our primaries coming up in just over a week here, what we were doing here was telling people, look, we've got a fight to save the country, and you have to treat this campaign as a national campaign as your means of intervening directly into the government of the United States now to save the country. And to do that, we've got to use this shift that's occurred of this recent support for Glass-Steagall by some of the people who opposed it the most in the past, to now to ram this through in the full package, the full three-point package of the slate, oust Obama, and bring in a real industrial recovery. And then what we've been telling people is about the mobilization in D.C., and people have been extremely moved. They're relieved that they don't just have to wait around to vote for Obama or Romney or the lesser of two evils. And I've been meeting more and more people who are moved to tears, and also at the same time, the anger in the population at the breakdown of the physical economy is increasing. Which I'll just mention a few things on that. But first, also I'll mention that our slate of candidates has drafted a letter to all the delegates to the Democratic National Convention to nominate a different candidate, to dump Obama before or at the convention, and instead select someone who's qualified as someone who can actually fight for the American people and defend the American people, as Obama is clearly unqualified, as especially the recent weeks have demonstrated this administration's complicity in the murder of the population. Through covering for Timothy Geithner's involvement and cover-up for at least 5 years now of the biggest murder and theft operation probably in the history of our financial system, which is the rigging of the LIBOR.
Bill, you had a very important intervention in Detroit, and again, these campaigns are not local, but the fact is you live in a city, and you live right in a city that's been victimized by these policies. And I want you to just report to people what you did before the city council, and then tell them what happened Thursday night, where the mayor faced a mob. So clearly, right, we're seeing that kind of response in the population.
Yeah. Well, yeah, Detroit's a city that's been forced to cut massively from police and from fire, and you know this has resulted in people dying and people's lives being endangered. And I went down to the Detroit City Council meeting, and I told them that they had been the victims of a scam that was perpetrated at the highest levels of the financial system, that the interest rates that, you know, 75% of major cities pay on things like bond insurance were rigged against the city, and that they need to reject all cuts that endanger human life and instead support Glass-Steagall to shut down this criminal operation. And the response was very interesting. Councilwoman Joanne Watson immediately said that this was exactly correct, that Detroit had been forced in the recent years to pay extraordinarily high interest rates on their insurance because AIG went under and their interest rates were reset, and that they need to renegotiate. But then just Thursday night, there was a meeting that the mayor held in Detroit to address the constituency about this additional 10% cut in the police force, and 500 people showed up. And for the first 10 minutes of the session, the mayor could not get a single word in because the crowd was denouncing him and yelling and saying, "You're a low-down, dirty, no-good mayor." And they were chanting in support for the Detroit, they were chanting DPD in support of the police department who were leading
this. This is interesting because, you know, in Detroit in the past, you have this image of somewhat of a lawless town, the Halloween fires, the anti-police mentality. But leading the attack on the mayor were policemen.
Right. Right.
And, I think the important thing is that it's not just Detroit. As you said, the people who know something about these things is a SWAP group that said 75% of major U.S. cities were swindled by these SWAP arrangements. Detroit, Baltimore, Oakland, there are many, many more. But water districts, hospital districts, pension funds, even Charles Schwab is saying their mutual funds were scammed. So when people hear about LIBOR and they think it has something to do with bankers in London, it does. But it's bankers in London and Wall Street who have figured out how to squeeze extra money out of you. Now, let me go back to Michael for a moment. And, you know, you were there when they were grilling Geithner. From what I can gather, they let him off pretty easily compared to what should have happened. But what was the discussion going on around the LIBOR hearing?
Well, I think that in the House you had a kind of a contagious discussion. There is a much greater sensitivity, I think, right now coming from the House of Representatives towards the crisis. So not only was there a discussion of the LIBOR scandal in Glass-Steagall in a much more kind of urgent way, especially from people like Walter Jones, who we've worked with very well and closely, on the financial services.
He was on this program, in fact, Michael. He was on this program where he talked about the importance of making calls to congressional offices. He's a Republican from North Carolina, but one of the most principled men you'll find in the Congress.
Yeah, absolutely. There was also then discussions raised because you've also got clearly a scandal. It's not just the lending rates, the LIBOR rates. It is the energy prices. It is the food prices. And the Agricultural Committee this week held hearings on the same kinds of scandals taking place on food commodities. And so, again, the Glass-Steagall question was raised there and was elaborated by the Republican chairman of the committee on what Glass-Steagall is and what it does. So there is a certain kind of groundswell of activity in the House. And I encourage, again, the listeners, call, but also get your friends and political groups and neighbors. Get them to call in. This Glass-Steagall has reached a height of activity, and there's no way in hell that the American people should let their Congress go on vacation when the ability to save the first step in saving our country could be accomplished by the end of this week, if not sooner. Now, the bigger problem is the Senate. The Senate, as John McCain has explicitly said, is controlled by Wall Street. The problem is he's in the Senate. So these guys need to break, and we are putting a lot of energy into this process. But the bigger question is the American people. If the American people move now with a sense of urgency, there is nothing that can stop us from saving the country. It is up to us now in moving. And I think it's not only the political activity we need, but people have to have a commitment towards the future, not just getting Glass-Steagall, not just getting justice for the errors that have been made in the past. We've got to get a commitment to developing this younger generation and ensuring that this country survives for the next century. And if we do that, I think we can win.
And Michael, let me ask you a question that I know is on the minds of a lot of our listeners. We have many people who, when we talk to them, they just say, "I just want to know, are you for Obama or Romney?" And they're stuck in that box. But it seems to me that we're beginning to pick up from the Democratic side. It doesn't look to me as though any office holders are going to be at the Democratic convention. We're seeing retreats, and we'll get a report from Bill in a moment on the Ohio Democratic Convention, where he is right now. But in neither party is there much enthusiasm for the two candidates. So what are we, when we tell people, when we tell Democrats, you've got to dump Obama, what kind of reaction are we getting?
Well, I think it's hard to say. It depends on who we're talking with at this point. I think it's very important to note, and I think this is very relevant to the question, we've had the first co-signer to Walter Jones's H.R. 107 of the Democratic Party. Michaud from Maine, the congressman from Maine, who's also a signer to Marcy Kaptur's H.R. 1489, has now been the first Democrat to sign on calling for a discussion of the threats of impeachment towards Obama regarding his foreign policy, or what's called the Tony Blair Doctrine, the illegal invasion of Libya and the ongoing threat of an illegal invasion into Syria. This is the kind of hearing that people should be pushing for, and I think the intention this week should not only be to get Glass-Steagall passed, but to have hearings in the committees in Congress on H.R. 107. And people should call their congressman and insist that Obama should be put on trial now for his crimes against humanity. They're clear. The indictment is there. People know it. And the only reason Republicans aren't moving is for their own kind of political opportunism. And that's got to be called out by the American people, because there's more that can be done right now to save this country than people can probably imagine.
And, Bill, you're at the Ohio Democratic Convention. You said it seems to be somewhat fewer people and less enthusiasm. Can you give us a capsule summary of what's going on there?
Yeah, sure. Yeah, I think there are less people here. And apparently there's only maybe one member of the Ohio congressional delegation coming today. So I'm sure that's not going to inspire total optimism in, you know, the agenda here. But you know, we came to talk to people about this shift that's got to occur in the program necessary for economic recovery. And when we tried to register for the event, coming in from out of state, they wanted us to sign a loyalty oath to the President of the United States. And I just said, we prefer someone else to be nominated at the Democratic Convention, so I'm not going to sign this. And they said, oh, okay, well, and it created this whole sort of, you know, scene where they were trying to figure out.
It shows you the insecurity when they're saying that you have to bow in obeisance to the President before you can even get into the meeting.
Well, right, and you know, and maybe that has something to do with why so few people are attending these things. They're sort of painting themselves into a corner.
Yeah. Well, we saw the same thing in the West Virginia Democratic Convention, and now we find that many leading elected Democratic officials in West Virginia are not going to go. The congressman whose district adjoins the Charlotte, North Carolina Convention Center said he's not going to go. He's a Democrat, and he says he's going to be busy campaigning. Well, he's a stone's throw away from the convention. So you see the rats deserting the sinking ship. Now, I think what I'd like to do, since we've given people a sense of the background of this, is to get into the more, let's just say, the future orientation that you were talking about, Michael, in terms of the what Lynn is doing and what he's putting forward as the way that we will ensure not just that these programs will work to provide a little bit of extra revenue, but actually create revolutionary changes. And I think that the two of you are well situated for that, because you're in the middle of this fight, Michael, and Bill, you're in the Detroit area where we've seen the destruction of the machine tool capability of the United States. So, Michael, from the discussion today with Lynn, you said he brought up this question of where we go from here. How did he pose that?
Well, I liked what he had said on kind of capturing the principle of it, that Glass-Steagall needs a future. We don't merely need to correct for the wrongs that have occurred. And I think people have to get a sense of this. This is a very important question. There is a reason why these bankers have moved. There's a reason why Sandy Weill and the LA Times and the New York Times expressed great, you know, regret for ever having supported the repeal of Glass-Steagall. There is a real fundamental crisis. Now, from a banker's perspective, from these bankers' perspective, it is a collapse of the entire global financial system. But they themselves fail to realize the repercussions that have occurred. For decades now, we have had an economy based on finance and money. And people know this. We've seen the bubbles. We've seen the financial orientation. especially for the last two decades, and an emphasis more and more since the Gore policy of environmentalism has taken over U.S. policy in the early 90s. We have failed to develop a younger generation capable of sustaining a decent society, let alone our nation and civilization. And we're going to have to quickly repair that question and develop a sense of citizenry within this generation of under 30 and even emphatically the under 20. And you see the emotional despair like we saw in Colorado now. And so one thing he laid out in the NECs recently, the discussions we have here amongst our associates, is the NWAPA project begins that. It begins on a very basic skill level, essentially preparing for the major dam and reservoir constructions to prepare for the pumping stations in Idaho, the distribution areas in the Southwest. These are very basic construction projects. We are not yet prepared to have a generation of 30 and under begin to develop nuclear power plants. The machining, the manufacturing, the construction levels need to be developed first. And really a question of a culture of work ethic, of developing a society. It's different to have a society where you're trying to avoid despair and a society which you're actually working and sacrificing for the future generations. And we've got to now ingrain that in the next generation. So NWAPA is going to be the starting process. And from there, we're going to establish a platform of real work, of real productivity, that will give these younger generation a sense of dignity and pride in giving something to the next generations. And from there, we can begin to move very rapidly with the breakthroughs in things like thermonuclear fusion, which are clearly on the horizon and can happen within the next 25 years, within a generation. So that's definitely the discussion here.
With NWAPA, Mr. LaRouche is talking about somewhere around 4 million who would be engaged in the construction side of this. I mean, there are quite a few construction workers who are unemployed, although perhaps not in the kind of engineering-type work that would be involved in the lifting of water and the creation of dams, but you can see where you could get a pool for that. The other part of NWAPA is the 2 million or so what he calls Michigan-Ohio-type jobs. And, of course, this is, you know, Obama claims he saved the auto sector with a bailout, and yet, in fact, the unemployment rates are still very high in Ohio and Michigan. People who are working in many cases in different kinds of jobs, which are actually downgrades. They're not in machine tooling. And Bill, give us a sense of how you see this from the formerly industrial Midwest.
Well, it's pretty clear that when you talk about the massive size of NWAPA, and I think our total of the 4 million jobs that were from the original NWAPA calculations, that is that if you take all these very large dams that are going to be built, the tunnels, the canals, and so forth, that this is going to require 4 million jobs in construction, engineering, and so forth. But then when you tally up, as we've done in this NWAPA 21 special report, all of the vast material and equipment requirements, and then the 40,000 miles of rail and high-speed rail that are going to need to be constructed, you're obviously talking about Michigan and Ohio is going to be lit up like a Christmas tree, because that massive amount of materials and equipment is going to going to require a massive expansion of the industrial base of the Midwest. And so it's 2 million more jobs here. But when you consider the fact that these are the types of jobs that are created anytime you're setting up a new productive process, even just to get it going, that's obviously going to be the spearhead for the much larger employment question, which is the fact that 80 million people are out of work right now, many young people, and many of whom have no skills to speak of and are not part of a productive culture at all. So this is really, NWAPA is really the starting point for an industrial renaissance and a longer term recovery and development process.
Well, it also gets to a fundamental question in economics, which is that we've been told repeatedly by Greenspan and others over the last two decades that we were having productivity gains that were the reason for the so-called financial gains. And, of course, the productivity gains they were talking about was the increased speed of digital manipulation, essentially, and the power of computers, which we found out was a complete fraud because the so-called monetary component of these gains were bubbles. And these bubbles popped, and we were left with nothing, and people scratching their heads saying, how could we have such great productivity gains and still have a flat or a declining economy? Now, Michael, I know you've worked on this quite a bit in terms of classes you've done and intervening in the scientific labs in the San Francisco Bay Area. This question of productivity for you is very different from what it is for Alan Greenspan.
Well, I think that it's easy to make the comparison, and in San Francisco, you know, it wasn't long ago that the governor of California, which is facing an entire bankruptcy of the state, its cities, and of course the state itself, that Jerry Brown proclaimed the future of the California economy to be Facebook. And within a week of declaring that, you had a complete collapse of Facebook after its public offering, because all the investors know this is one giant, massive bubble of people subscribing to a kind of a complete empty culture, internet culture. And the point is, look, you can't eat the food on Farmville. You know, that's just not going to happen. So people know that. And the older generations, especially the generation nearing retirement and having these young children coming out of college and moving back in with them or scraping together a job at Starbucks or at a restaurant or something, they realize that there is something fundamentally missing from our orientation in society. What they've got us begin to do is orient now, help orient this country back in this direction. Real farming, real agricultural, real production. And we can do that. NAWAP is just the start. It's just the beginning. But it indicates the future. It indicates where we can go. And it does, as everyone recognizes, it ends this insanity of an environmentalist agenda, which has clearly choked California from the leading agro-industrial state in our country to falling into the pits of financial despair today. We've got to get back to this orientation we had before.
And Bill, you mentioned earlier that you taught, you're beginning to elicit tears from people in Michigan when you talk to them about a life of dignified, productive labor. When you're campaigning, because you're in the middle of a fight right now, you're running against a guy who claims you're not a Democrat. He won't debate you. He won't discuss issues. He's a supporter of the president. And, you know, I think that you're tapping into something in the population that he has no clue is there. But are you finding that you can get people remoralized after the years of despair that's characterized that situation?
Yeah, well, one lady I was talking to yesterday actually, who was one of these people that was, you know, nearly brought to tears by just a frank discussion of what actually this country has been put through, remarked that she feels like that she's awoken from a coma, that she can't even believe where things have gotten in this period. And you know, I think the fact that people see that we are committed to fighting, no matter what, against party structures, against popular opinion, and providing clear leadership, you know, in the face of you know, in a face of a defense of Obama and defense of Romney and all this sort of thing, yeah, people are moved. People are moved by it, and I think that what we've got to make sure to do, though, is to, as much as possible, bring these people immediately into the fight, so that they have a sense internally of what's required to win, and to wrestle with what's required to be able to bring maybe their own friends and family out of the type of of pessimism that maybe they don't suffer from. But the thing with pessimism is it's always sort of a thing where you're looking at the next person and saying, well, I don't know, how can I get all these other people to do something? And to come into the fight that we're waging to get a sense of the reality of the situation from the top down and how vulnerable this system is and how much of an opportunity we do have to shift it immediately.
Well, and Bill, what are you going to be doing the next 10 days, and how can people help your campaign? How can the listeners do something to help you?
Well, a couple of things that we've been doing pretty effectively is some very large traffic intersection deployments with very large banners that say, Obama out, Glass-Steagall in. And some door-to-door distributions. And in the next couple of days, I think we're also going to be bringing our message to the city councils so that they are increasing the pressure on their members of Congress and not just sitting around waiting to be slashed by increased budget cuts. So there's a number of these things, and people can call in or contact us through the website to get involved.
And what is your website? Why don't you give people the name?
It's www.BillRobertsForCongress.com.
Pretty simple.
Yeah.
So, Michael, we've got this new week coming up. We don't know what's going to happen going into it, except we know what we're going to do. What are some of the things we have planned?
Well, like I mentioned earlier, we're pulling together a couple of things. One is a very clear indictment of Obama. People know the crimes. It's now a question of an impetus to move on it. We've got, as I said, a Democratic signer onto H.R. 107, so people can definitely call in and should to encourage fellow Democrats and Republicans to sign on to this. We're going to be laying out a pamphlet, which will be in the hands of the staffers and the congressmen as they get onto Capitol Hill. The week is starting late. Congressmen will be coming back in. The House comes in Wednesday night. The Senate comes in Tuesday night. And they'll be in session minimally through Friday. Our intention is to set up a number of meetings. We're going to be targeting very specific districts of those congressmen who are on the cusp of signing on to the Glass-Steagall bill. And we will try to make that, at least within our locals nationally, in California and in Washington, Detroit, Baltimore and Boston and New Jersey, Houston, a very clear targeting of some of the congressmen that should move immediately to restore this basic principle into law. So that's the basis of it, and we will be responding as the situation develops. I think people should plan on further interventions coming based on the crisis that we face. And people should drop whatever excuses they had. I think the point Bill's making, people drop the pessimism that something can't be done, that Congress will never move. This is an excuse for your own death. We've got to move now, and people should do everything possible. It matters. It counts. At this point, the battle lines have been drawn, and we can win, but we have to move.
Well, and this is, we had a report from Deborah Freeman, who's Mr. LaRouche's national spokeswoman, that to put Glass-Steagall before the Congress does not take some dramatic event. Any one of the co-sponsors could insist that it be brought up, get it put into a committee and heard. You're going up against a certain inertia, but the crisis is profound. I mean, I can just report that from Europe, in the first part of the week, there was total Euro despair. You know, everything's falling apart, nothing can be done, Spain's collapsing. Spain is now 25% official unemployment. The Spanish bailout was signed, and everyone said it's not going to work. And then, miraculously, on Thursday, Mario Draghi, the head of the European Central Bank, came out and said, don't worry, we will make liquidity available as needed, as much as needed, at the moment it's needed. And all of a sudden, the clouds lifted, the sun came out, and the stock market went through the roof for a couple of days. Now, everyone knows on Monday they're going to be confronted with the fact that nothing has changed except that there's less money available and more bailouts that are needed. So this idea that things are going to continue in a linear fashion is something that people have to give up. and recognize that history does change based on what individuals do. Now, Bill, let me just ask you, because the situation in your region is, as we were talking earlier, is quite depressed. Are you getting a sense that people are, this report you gave from the Detroit mayor getting booed, this is a guy who was a popular hero in the past. He was a basketball star for the Detroit Pistons. So clearly that doesn't matter anymore. There's a shift in the thinking of people.
Yeah. Yeah, no, it's even some of these previous meetings, it's clear that people are being unified around a sense that something has to be done. That at this point they're killing people in order to pay a debt. And so the the question on everyone's mind, is the answer to it is Glass-Steagall. You know, everyone, we go outside of the district into the farm belt. And, you know, here you have this food crisis. Nothing's been done by the federal government. There's no food stores because they're trying to prop up an investment bubble. And so everything is converging on the necessity of Glass-Steagall. And it's either that or we lose the country. So I just, you know, again, to our listeners, this is not just another extended fight that's going on forever. This is now. This is the opportunity now to ram this thing through the Congress and make it, and tell your congressman, look, we don't want to see your ugly face back in the district. We're not interested in voting for someone who's not mobilized to save the country. So slap your name on that thing and introduce it and put it through so we don't go through hell. Now, and that should be the role of the constituency at this point.
That's absolutely the right point. One point that we've been making to the members of Congress who try to present the idea that you have to do a bureaucratic process, people should remember that it was Monday morning they tried to ram through the bailout in the autumn of 2008. And the constituencies across the country put the phones on fire in Washington, and both chambers voted against the bailout. But after a number of attempts by Wall Street and interventions, by Friday, the bailout was rammed through. And this does not take a long bureaucratic process. It takes a sense of leadership, and it takes a direct participation from the American citizens. With those two things and our intervention into D.C., we can get this thing moving this week.
So
there's no guarantee, but there has to be a commitment.
If bad things can be done quickly, and by the way, in the bailout, one of the key roles played in reversing the vote and getting the bailout through was played by then-Senator Barack Obama, who was the Democratic presidential candidate, who basically told Democrats that if they wanted anything from him as president, they had to vote for the bailout. So you're saying that that same process can get something done quickly for the good?
Absolutely.
Michael, let me just, we have about 10 minutes left, and I wanted to come back to something that you talked about earlier, but we didn't really go into, which is the question of fusion, the question of new technologies, and that this is the basis of productivity gains, and that this requires a change in thinking. You've been doing a lot of work with NWAPA, with the scientists, a very significant scientific cadre force in the San Francisco Bay Area, and I'm not talking about the ones who are developing more powerful marijuana, but the real scientists there. To what extent have you seen an excitement about ideas there and this despair about the future, but also the potential of the future?
Well, I'll say it was interesting. Actually intersected a top fusion, as a plasma scientist who works directly with Princeton Plasma, Princeton Fusion Labs, this week at one of the events on Capitol Hill. He was probably in his early 40s, and he was incredibly engaged regarding the entire current fallacy of the global economic system. He sees that the entire orientation of science today is the same financial model of Wall Street. It is immediate short-term gains at the cost of the society itself. And until that's reversed, you can have no true scientific endeavor or scientific advancement. Because science requires a completely different view of what what Mr. LaRouche has been emphatic on over the course of his tenure as a leading economist, that the idea of what humanity is generations. It's going back all the way to the point of the beginnings of modern civilization, back to Homer, but being able to think generations ahead. And without that capability, and this is what he's been referencing with Furtwängler and Bach's principle, if you don't see a continuous process of development over generations, you have no true scientific or advancement of mankind. You have no progress. You have no profit. And it was very interesting to see how this is one of the best responses I've seen. So I think the idea of a mass strike, that if we get Glass-Steagall passed and we get an orientation that shows an uphill development, we can see the scientific potential unleashed. And fusion technology, a viable source of consumer energy, can be developed within 25 years, within that one generation. People will be able to see their grandchildren becoming fusion engineers on this planet, but also even on the Moon and Mars. That's a viable alternative right now if we fight for it. And I think that's really imperative, but also very compelling.
And that's directly related to the Mars issue, because you're not going to get to Mars with existing rockets, with the so-called private sector approach. And again, Bill, I know when you campaign, maybe you haven't had this so much, but Keisha Rogers, who's running in right next to the district of NASA, when she would bring up Mars program, people would say, oh, this is crazy. Why are you talking about Mars? When you talk about the future, do you get that, or are you getting people, as Mike is saying, inspired by this idea that there can be things done that have never been done before?
No, people hate the fact that Obama has killed the space program, especially Democrats. I mean, this is one of the major things. NASA has been one of the major points of optimism of the American population, and especially here. And, yeah, people are people who almost agree with Obama on, or think they do on other things, even they admit that this is the most horrible, stupid thing that the president could have done, and that there's absolutely no reason for it. But I would come back to one thing that Michael was saying, which is this, I mean, on this future orientation, this is the larger principle that lies behind, I think, why a number of people in the financial community have been forced to admit that the repeal of Glass-Steagall has been a failure. And I think the one thing that's funny about it, you know, Sandy Weill said that he said his reason why now he supports going back to Glass-Steagall is that it's a different time. It's a different time than it was than when it was repealed. But of course, it was always wrong, and that there's a universal principle as to why it was wrong. And that's why, you know, simply going back to Glass-Steagall isn't enough. There's a larger economic principle here, which necessitates an American system, American system credit policy, so that a future is not something that comes out of the markets. A future is something that's willfully created by human beings. So,
and that requires a psychological shift.
Right.
It requires a shift in the way people think. And, you know, Michael, again, when you guys go into the Congress and you're talking to people in congressional offices, there's no one who's in more of a box than most of the people in the Congress. It's a box controlled by the lobbyists, by the campaign funding mechanisms, and so on. But we're seeing that lift because of the crisis, aren't we?
Yeah, we certainly are. People, you know, life and death circumstances force people to have to make decisions that they normally try to avoid. And people, I think, in the population have to realize that a commitment to save this country is a decision you have to make every morning you wake up. Optimism is not something that happens as a mechanical effect of what you've previously done. It's a decision you make based on what you're going to do that day and through the course of your life. And I think a lot of the people in government who are decent and moral are realizing that the decisions they make today are not merely going to put food on their table tomorrow or get a paycheck on Friday, but will determine the outcome of our society and of our nation. And that has the kind of, that's creating the cultural change for discussion now to make these kinds of changes that we're discussing so very possible.
And I think for pessimists, the thing that, that one of the points I always make is that the people who say government is the problem, right now the problem with government is it's controlled by the wrong people. It's under the control of the corporate cartels, the banking and finance and insurance and so on. What would it be like if the government were acting for the interests of the people? What would it be like if the people were telling the government what was needed and the people were sending representatives who represented their future interests? And I think that's where the optimism comes in. And the LaRouche slate has been providing that uniquely. We had Keisha Rogers win the primary in Texas. Diane Sayre ran an absolutely excellent campaign in New Jersey. And Bill, you and Dave are up for election this Tuesday, not this coming Tuesday, but a week from this Tuesday. Any last words you have for in case there's some listeners in your district or people who want to help your campaign?
Yeah, well, I think, Harley, as you pointed out at the beginning of the call, this campaign has always been more about changing the ideas in government and getting certain ideas out than it is a local campaign. But I think with that being said, the idea that we can by actually concentrating on a situation that, well, here for example, there is a lot of focus on this particular congressional race, because of some of the stranger things that happened about it, but also because it's in an area of the country where it's been devastated by this crisis. And so I would just invite people to get involved now as a commitment to a fight on a national level in which this local election, so-called, has the potential to shift the national our national government immediately. I mean, this is, everyone who picks up the paper knows that I'm the Democrat who wants Obama thrown out, and that there's just been widespread coverage of that, and we should actually throw him out. So I'll just say that.
Well, and I'll say, as the host of the show, that no matter where you live, you can help deliver a shock on a week from this coming Tuesday by helping Bill Roberts' campaign. Go on to his website, BillRobertsForCongress.com. Make a contribution. Contact anybody you know in the Detroit area. Get them out to vote. You know, this is the kind of effect, a victory there will send a shock effect across the world. And, of course, if we don't win the race, what we're still doing is we're changing the nature of history because of the leadership of the slate, showing to people in the Congress that you don't have to go along to get along, that you can provide leadership. And Michael and Bill, it's been a pleasure having you on the program today. We do have a second week of action, and as Michael pointed out, if we do our job, maybe the Congress will be forced to stay in Washington for another week, maybe two more weeks, maybe through the convention, and put through the legislation that's necessary to save the nation. Now, Michael, will we have this new pamphlet up on the website by Monday? Do you know?
We are in a rush production, but we are pulling together a kind of a higher conception of what we need to accomplish as we speak right now. So it will be up as soon as possible. So people should just stay on our website, you know, frequently throughout the days coming ahead here, and be willing to put it to work as soon as possible.
So you have your work cut out for you, the listeners. Mobilize your congressmen. Get them to meet with the LaRouche PAC organizers. Get them to go with a three-point program and bring yourself up to snuff. Be on the website. Study the work. If you have questions, there's an email address. There are phone numbers. There's no excuse for not participating in this mobilization, which has already changed human history. So, Michael and Bill, thanks again for joining us today.
Thanks, Harley.
Thanks, Harley.
And this has been another edition of The LaRouche Show. Every Saturday, 3 p.m., and you can find it on LaRouchePub.com in an archive so you can listen to it and send it to your friends. Join us next week for the next edition of The LaRouche Show. Thanks and goodbye.